Tuesday of every month, pick a plane, fly again, and fly to... One hour of spectacular sound surprises. Mix live with a different guest host each month. Improve your tech right at home. Tune in and turn on Flag Air Base 88.1 CKLN.
CKLN FM 88.1. Always testing the waters. Your first alternative community radio station in Toronto.
Twin Peaks. I'm getting nervous. What's happening? I don't even watch the show. But I go down to take a walk in my neighborhood. In the street behind me at number 22 Beloil, there's a restaurant there. And until a few days ago, it used to be called Carl's. Now, it's called the Owl's Nest at 22 Beloil. That's getting really close. I think something's about to happen. Oh, no!
Here's a quote from Finnegan's Wake that I think might shed some light on last week's Twin Peaks. He was feeling like he was lost in the bush, boy. Lead, kindly, fowl. They always did. Ask the ages. What bird has done yesterday, man may do next year. Be it fly, be it molt, be it hatch, be it agreement in the na-na-na. For her socio-scientific is sound as a bell, sir. Her volucrine automotiveness right on normalcy. She knows. She just feels she was kind of born to lay and love eggs. Yes, before all this has time to end, the golden age must return with its vengeance.
Hi, Bob. Scott, I don't expect this to be a particularly original observation, but the Amtrak train that derailed in Boston on Wednesday was called the Night Owl.
Bob Jobs is an intellectual thug, slowly accumulating a vast wealth of resources, a vast arsenal with the intention of using it. I don't think he's a member of the We Party. Bye-bye.
Who's Bob?
Oh, Bob must be the one responsible for Michelet's death.
If you want to know the truth, you know the answer to your mystery. It is Bob who holds the key to the future of Kessler. Bob will come with the music. Bob will come with the music. Bob will come with the music.
Bob will come with the music. Bob will come with the music. Bob will come with the music.
What? I don't want to miss this Bob character who will change Canada's future. Bob character who will change Canada's future. Change Canada's future.
Wait, listen. Music.
The giant said Bob will come with the music.
But maybe now we'll find out who this mysterious Bob person is.
Look.
The 90s, Bob. Gotta love it. Bob. What's new? Bob. The story of Robert Campo. The boom and bust of Bob. The story of Robert Ray. The bust and boom of Bob. The story of Robert Dean. The boom and boom of Bob. My Bob.
Hello, Bob. It's Guelph calling. Just finished from Cliché to Archetype. Very stimulating. Thought I'd leave with you some entries from my Red Book Notes, Book 3, beginning with number 236. Who was Beethoven? An essay to write. Dimension. Opening. Deepening. If art obsolete, what art to do? Because that can't be true. Some art is, and that's back at the rag and bone shop. Take in all kinds of material and use it. Get pissed. I am of at least two minds. Perhaps 22 or 14. Sometimes I'll hide my sources because I am aware that certain names, sounds will immediately tune out and get that too familiar glazed look. I'll plagiarize something just to get the idea across, which may be quite excellent, but with the particular author's name tagged to it will keep it from flying. You know what I mean? As series, so seriousness. A new lease on life and art. There are degrees of solipsism, certainly, and also that we all are solipsistic to our own personal solipsistic degree. If you don't get drunk or stoned on occasion, can you really understand? Ambiguity? Tongue in check? I go fanatic for a while, once in a while. Clears out the toxic cobwebs. When you're a fanatic, you're clean and pure. That's nice. To be an artist, you gotta get real dirty. Everything I write becomes an immediate cliche. I am hard at work, making of myself an archetype for others who come after me to use me as such. Blue boy wanders into dust. I have recently experienced a knowledge explosion. Many people are alienated. This is a natural, normal state, especially, it seems, in the last decade of the 20th century. The clinical multiple personality is a great metaphor for the times. Our business may be culture, but our hobby surely is the reconciliation of our personal multiple personalities. How to be all we are can be. If we're all culture workers, what culture are you working for? Big Woods remembered again. Talk is for losers and fools. When you're brimming, you're free. There's something ultimately... Yeah, continuing with Red Book Notes, Book 3, I'm at number 255. There is something ultimately unsatisfying about satisfaction. Whatever they might say, chances are it's not meant as a metaphor for our time, but is a fact of our time. We're also duped, uneducated. Ha ba ha hoo. Stay drunk, stay lucid always. I return. It's amazing. Whatever has come before is available to us. We are afraid to do anything, use anything, or are we? Whose side are you on? You might alienate yourself into a corner where the center is everywhere and the boundaries are nowhere. This is Janus. In the age of dice, chance be your method. In homeopathy, the more fine-tuned, the better the effect, i.e. healing for the patient. Is it so amazing for me to realize that one day, if I play my cards right, I'll have my 15 minutes of running the world? Andy Warhol was just another culture worker. When you step out, you see. Let the world think anything. All that paranoia shit is over. Now what? Life in the fast lane is so very, very slow. The homeopathic principle is a way of life. What happens when everyone goes homeopathic? There's a thought to contemplate. You keep the tetrad in mind and everything flips, so detachment is a fabulous strategy. Detachment is everything, is freedom. You never know when the muse of all muses is going to dwell in your fingers for a time and tell you what's what. I channel in the most unlikely places. It's the fucking crazy people. I'm traveling on and in incredible lands. I will write a great novel. I understand Finnegan's Wake. Emotion is everything, and so is intellect. Writing in public places is like getting up on stage and taking out your pudenda and giving it a serious rub. Public places are private places. I am a mystical being. I know someone who is the greatest artist alive. It's simply his turn. Your private citadel of consciousness is just that, private. Therefore, everything offered for public consumption is but a hint. Is it my error to spew my knowledge on unsuspecting, curious people? The trick is detachment, to not care what the people, the mass mind, thinks. When you see that, you are under surveillance. The trick is to leak appropriate info. I am under disguise. I let everybody, and I mean everybody, think I am whatever they choose to think I am. I dump on unsuspecting victims. The nothing will eventually flip into the everything. Just a few more from the Red Book notes. I'm at 290 right now. Save the whales! Detach yourself from the tetrad. One of the major secrets is that there are indeed levels of comprehension. You learn from opening yourself to everything, not by rejecting everything. You make your philosophy foggy or clear depending upon what you want out of life. Or how about a combo of two approaches? Is this what the 22 signifies? A combo, two, of two approaches? Nudity is the great hidden ground. Live detached as if already dead. Exaggerate, lie, fabricate, invent, bullshit, distract. This is creativity. If someone talks to me, they get what they need. Thanks, Bob. Bye.
Not bad.
Fewer messages this week.
Made up by Guelph, though. Time-wise. Okay, this is our Nimrod's birthday special.
Nimrod?
Yeah, that's December 25th is really Nimrod's birthday, not our colleague, JC.
Oh, okay. Welcome.
This is
the last show of 1990, as you pointed out.
December 19th.
Yeah.
Bob's number, 19 BLB, adds up to 19.
And this is why we're doing two shows back-to-back.
So I hope some people remembered and they're out there listening tonight. And we've got to wait a few minutes. I got a Christmas present to lay on the nation.
Okay.
I know that the subgeniuses themselves especially have been waiting for Bob to tell us what's really going on there in the Middle East as we gear up for war. Well, okay, it's time we told you and helped you understand what happened and what's going to happen. And this is my present to all of us. So, Mike, I guess we shouldn't go too much further into an introduction. We have any phone calls yet? Nothing yet. Good. Okay, one point just before we do that. James B. left a message, but I didn't play it. I thought it would be better to just tell you in brief what he asked. He has been watching Twin Peaks. He missed the beginning, so he held off, did a little personal yoga, a little media ecology, waited till a friend of his came up with all the tapes. He apparently has gotten all the tapes. He's got a dilemma. He's going to Europe in January, and he's wondering whether to watch the tapes now, the problem being they're black and white. And this is for you, Mike, being an excellent technician, having been schooled in this area. Should he wait to get some color video, or should he take advantage of this three-week break in Twin Peaks and catch up, even though it's black and white? What do you think?
When is he back from Europe?
He said something about January 22nd. I don't know if that's when he leaves or he gets back.
Yeah.
I think he should play catch-up.
I think so, too.
He can always see it again.
Yeah. It'll be repeated.
Yeah. So, to take advantage of it, go ahead and see those. Must be about, 22 issues by now, 22 weeks.
Yeah. So there's a decision, James.
Okay, watch it over the holidays, and we hope to hear some analysis. He wanted to know if we had any idea for him to keep in mind. Well, basically, it's about you and I, about Mike and I.
Mm-hmm.
And he'll see that unfold. Note the dream in, I think, the third episode, at the beginning of the first series. The dream in there points out the Mike and Bob dialectic.
And maybe later, if there's a little space, I can bring this up.
Is that later? Okay,
later.
Yeah. So this is the Exus telling us about the Middle East. This was, when was this done? September 18th, 1990. I had a personal interview with them, and I was talking about the historical role of the oligarchs and how they foster wars, and they asked me to pick any war, so I picked the present one. So you got it lined up, right? So this is the Exus and Bob telling us. This is about 10 minutes. It's very interesting, and it'll tell you the hidden ground of what's happening.
If you realize that, pick any war you wish. Pick anyone.
Well, let's take this one, the Iraqi war.
Now, who is the main oligarchy here?
Foreign oil.
No. Oil is a form of power. But it's a power oligarchy. Power as in that which drive the engines. You see? Oil is a part of it.
Mm.
Now, Hussein seizes Kuwait. Why?
My little theory is that, with Sherman Scully, is that Kuwait was going to back out of the collapsing American economy. And a certain faction of American business wanted Hussein to grab Kuwait, freeze their funds, because Kuwait was going to pull out.
No, that is not half as strong. That's not the way this works.
Okay.
But the objective is, if you form a society, use that society to bring out the substances you need, then command that society. You own it. Oh, even though you say that someone else owns it, you own them.
Yeah.
Well, Hussein is owned. Who owns him?
Well, who does? Peter said the Rockefellers did.
To a strong extent, but that was earlier.
Yeah, in the early 80s.
Mm. But why would the Rockefeller interests push for war now?
Are you saying they are, or are you asking me why they would?
Why would they?
Because of what's going on in Europe.
No, because, that is a factor, but Saudi Arabia, the Emirates, etc., they're changing. They're changing rapidly. You see? They're becoming more independent.
Yeah.
They went through phase two of a process. They sold the oil, they got the money, they spent the money. They're broke. So therefore they sell the oil again.
And when was that?
That was last year.
Okay.
They began to put it over a push to sell oil. With the threat that because they wanted more money, they would push oil up higher. You see? At the base, FOB Bahrain, at $30 a barrel, which put it at POE, port of entry, at approximately $50 a barrel. You see?
Yes.
The profit of $50 per barrel is not high. So short term, oil delivered is $33 today, September 18th. Is $33. But that's not crude out of the ground. That's at the refinery. You see?
Yeah.
not to the producer, to the refinery. Now, with that in mind, how does one affect Saudi Arabia? Think of this as a war. Not so much. Though it will put Hussein in his position, i.e. out of power, out of influence. But who is the oligarchies of the United States? Who are they affecting the most? Saudi Arabia.
By being there.
Not only being there, offering assistance, etc. Price is going up $33, yes. But only because of lack of supply, not prices at the wellhead. You see?
Mm-hmm.
And if the Saudis think that they can do a price of $30 per barrel at the wellhead, then how do you stop them?
I don't know.
You go in, you aid them against Hussein, who is being manipulated into the position in which he is.
He was provoked starting last spring.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Now, get him attacking. Go in with your forces. Change Saudi Arabia, because what will happen is that Saudi Arabia is changing. Influence the royal families, etc. So that the Saudis realize they move the price to $30 at the wellhead, which they could do. They need to learn that they cannot do that. Not at the wellhead.
And the oligarchies that we talked about around the Vatican, the P2 Society, the last reading,
yes,
April 19th, is those ancient noble family groupings and secret Christian elite bankers, secret society, are they orchestrating the United States to do this for themselves?
No, they're affecting, however, the oligarchies that are in the United States.
By what they're doing in Europe?
By what they're doing in Europe,
so,
yes.
So this is a particular American oligarchy action,
yes,
the world events right now.
Exactly.
Can you name some of the members or families of that oligarchy?
No, but they're well known. Mostly associated with oil and power.
Yeah, the Seven Sisters.
Predominantly.
Yeah, and the Rockefellers. Now, why is Gorbachev cooperating with the Americans on that then?
Because he's going to get the better of the deal.
Yeah. With the oil and all that stuff in the next 10 years? In a good position?
He's in a good position to sell oil. But the carrot dangled out is, if he want to go to modernization of his country in the shortest possible time, fall in line and you will get the benefits.
And the computers and all that.
The computers, the road building machineries, the factories, the expert advice, the economists, the publishing aid, etc., etc.
And this was worked out at the summit in Malta in December?
It was initiated. It was not completely worked out. Much work has been done on this. Much work.
Yeah, because I just got LaRouche's Executive Intelligence Review today, their August 17th issue, and they outlined that from Malta through the events provoking Iraq. I just scanned it, but it looks like a good outline. Basically, they're saying it's an Anglo-Soviet American oil company combine that's manipulating the Middle East situation.
It is very apt.
So that particular issue is a good issue to give to people, to Xerox.
Yes.
A good summary of what's really going on.
A good summary.
Now, they take the angle, though, that this is a reaction by Russia and England and the United States oligarchies against what's going on in Europe in forming this new stronghold that's coming out of Europe. That is a part of the consideration.
It is to be considered. But realize,
but that affected Saudi Arabia, right?
It affected, yes.
Yeah. So Saudi Arabia reacted, and they did what they did this past year.
Yes.
And now they see the consequences. They know what this hidden agenda is. They know why Hussein was provoked. They see what they're going to lose in this situation, so to speak. Now they have to fall in the line, right?
They have to fall in line. They're keeping the price down.
And they now are learning that?
They're learning that.
Through shell diplomacy and Baker and
everything.
And then they have to figure it out, or is it told to them?
It's told to them.
So again, this war, the coverage of it is not telling us what's really going on behind the scenes.
No.
The manipulation. So he got duped. He's going to lose. And the world will think they beat up the new Hitler. But the real thing is that the Hitler in the United States, symbolically speaking, has brought the Middle East into line.
Yes. But what also happened is the collapse of the Ba'athist Party in Iraq.
Yeah. And the American oligarchs will take advantage of that.
Exactly.
And the Saudi Arabians will take advantage of that, but also adjust.
Yes.
Yeah.
But the recriminatory actions, the collapse of the Ba'athist regime, means that Iraq will then fractionalize, go to then various families, as it was before. It will be in a state of disarray. As that happened, it would be easier to negotiate.
The Middle East grouping with the American grouping?
Yes.
And we'll call it the Anglo-American with a little help from Gorbachev.
Yes.
Yeah.
Furry Lint. So I guess Saddam Hussein is the latest furry lint to be brushed off the giant sweater.
Two questions.
Yeah.
One, what when you refer to the Seven Sisters...
Yeah, they.
That's
a traditional term for the oil companies. When I'm reading this profile of the Anglo-American oil companies, I've just used six. That's Royal Dutch Shell, British Petroleum, Exxon, Chevron, Mobil, and Texaco. But back in the 70s, there were seven.
Mm-hmm.
So,
And what was the regime referred to, the Iraqi regime?
Ba'athist.
Ba'athist?
Yeah, that's the name of the party. It's B-A-A-T-H-I-S-T. Supposedly a socialist party.
Okay.
And, any other questions?
No.
No. So that was the Exodus talking to me on September 18th, telling us the hidden ground. Now, I have an update from the Exodus. I guess the mystery man of the last 4.5 months has been Saddam Hussein. What has he been thinking? What's he perceived that he's doing? He's the present furry lint, you might say. Okay, so I just want to read a little excerpt from an Exodus reading. It was sent to me, a fax to me, a private reading, explaining the state of mind of Saddam Hussein and how he got himself into this position. I mean, what does he think he's doing? So we haven't got any calls yet, eh? Okay. So this was done in early November, 1990, and then they typed it up and sent it to me a few weeks ago. Now, the Exodus say, the problem with Saddam Hussein is that he believes himself to be an international politician. Worse, he believes he is a powerful international politician. Even worse still, he believes himself to be a powerful international politician who can be effective in dealing with other powerful international politicians. With each deputation arriving in Baghdad to secure the release of Hussein's guests, he believes his stature increases. In the holding of foreign nationals and releasing them piecemeal, only upon the pleadings of visiting heads of state, he believes he is not only holding off a war, but is gaining international recognition for his humanitarianism. From this viewpoint, he projects his elevated international status on his political visitors and believes they are his equals and that they respect his analyses of Iraq versus the world. He sincerely believes that the U.S. is the aggressor and all other countries joining the United States and Saudi Arabia are there because the U.S. blackmailed them into joining. When Hussein's advisors tried to change his mind about his views, he had the army officer shot and the civilian advisors fired. He replaced them with members of his own family, thus further insulating himself from opposing opinion. Iraq recently came out the victor in the Iraq-Iran war, and although Hussein gave back much of what he won to Iran to secure its allegiance against the United States, Hussein believes that he would be the victor again when the U.S. attacks. He has said that the Gulf forces would never attack because they are not prepared to lose 10,000 people a day in battle. Hussein also believes the reason the Gulf forces have not attacked is because his human shield policy is working, and that even with the hostage guests returned, the Gulf forces would not attack because his defenses of Kuwait are impregnable. Saddam Hussein lives in a bubble that he creates. This is what the Exodus are saying. His call for a holy war against the West by all Muslims around the world fell flat on his face. that flat on its face, and it is doubtful any Muslim country will come physically to his aid when the war commences. His reinforcing of troops in Kuwait have stretched his supply lines, and his entrenchment of the area can be attacked easily from the rear in a pincer movement by the Gulf forces. Also, Hussein does not realize the facilities of the Gulf forces. Several satellites have been moved to the region, improving visual and radio communications. Stealth fighter and bombers regularly overfly his country, mapping his forces. And continually, his own arms deteriorate as spare parts become unavailable due to the embargo. Already, a significant percentage of his aircraft forces are unable to fly because of an insufficiency of parts. Saddam Hussein, because he is insulated from world opinion and believes himself to be a world leader, will bring down Iraq. He will not hesitate to use poison gas, and this will bring down the wrath of the United States in a form that will virtually destroy Iraq. Expect that President George Bush will get the go-ahead from the United Nations to use military force, and that Iraq will sue for peace only weeks after the initial attack. Hussein believed that he could walk into Kuwait unhindered, and while other nations would howl, little would be done. He believed that by the taking of Kuwait, all the Arab countries along the Gulf would fall like dominoes into his hands because they would believe that he is the reincarnation of Nebuchadnezzar and has a rightful destiny to be ruler of all Arabs. In this, he feels his manifest destiny is to be the one not only to unite all Arabs under one ruler, but to also be the spokesman for all Arabs. To him, the discussion about Kuwait is only an extension of all Arab problems. It is a mistake to see him as a socialist since he is not interested in social reform, but in the gathering of Arabs under his banner. And that's how I'll end with that statement. There's more, but best leave that for another time. So that's the Exodus describing Saddam Hussein's, from their point of view, tragic state of mind. So it's going to be a sad month in January.
We should mention, I don't know if it's appropriate here, that should we mention what you told me earlier about Kent?
No.
Not in any detail, but just that Ken may be leaving his show.
Yeah, if we can get some protests outside of Kent's home and plead for Kent to stay, then the work of Club 22 can carry on. Otherwise, Club 22 will stop at 2 o'clock in the new year.
I'd also like to say that today was the final broadcast by Andy Stachansky, who's leaving.
Where's he? I heard him on Monday.
Today was his last show.
Where's he going?
He's just too busy, I think.
Too busy. The Christmas holidays.
So, losing a couple of members here at CKLN.
So, vast changes here.
Yeah. Anyway, I just thought I'd slip that in.
So, if you can call Kent, he's not here tonight, I don't think. He won't be here, but he'll be back in the 1st of January. Give him a call and encourage him to stay. Otherwise, Kent, we don't know what's going to happen to him. I mean, no one has ever left Club 22 and gone out on their own. It's a frightfully tremendous risk. By Kent.
Maybe we should take over Andy's show.
Go back to our original roots.
No,
I like the Night Owl, man. Night Owl is where we're at.
You're listening to the Church of the Subgenius Show, the final show of 1998. Tonight's theme is...
That was a Christmas present by me. That would cost a lot of Subgenius and Pink's
a lot of money.
Great deal of money to hear that transcript.
Private sessions are a great deal of money, and I know they come out of your own pocket.
But the church funds.
Maybe
church
we could talk about the year in review.
We don't have any callers yet. I think they are back on the 2-week cycle. They didn't hear a warning. There's nobody listening tonight.
Yeah.
They missed the valuable information. But maybe they're just seeing if we can say some more interesting stuff. How about, what do you say about the past year, Mike? It's been a good year for you.
It's been a great year for me. Yeah, in hindsight. It's going to be a busier year, in fact, coming up, I think, for me. But I'll still pursue, you know, what we do here. I think it's important. I think the church has reached a new height. It's reached its peak. I don't know how higher it can go.
Yeah, well, I guess the peak is to address the nation on January 1st on Breaking the Waves.
Mm-hmm.
CBC, and that will happen. Tune in between 11 and 11:30, apparently, that night on New Year's Day, not New Year's Eve, New Year's Day. And hear my address to the nation. And where do we go from there? We've reached national recognition.
Well, I think, the last couple of weeks, having the ability to communicate with people from across the country, I don't think that's ever been done here on this station or on any other community station where we can have callers from Winnipeg, from Montreal, and actually communicate with them.
I think International Women's Day has done it. I don't know if they were taped or whatever, but
many of them were taped, and they may have done some live ones, but they were, set up ahead of time.
Yeah, this is ongoing, and we can get more callers anytime from around the world.
Mm-hmm.
And when they call in and put on hold, they can listen to the CKLN Music, which at this point is us.
Yeah.
We got a call?
We do have a call. So
okay.
We've had enough bullshitting there. We got a call. Hello.
Bob, it's the electrified voice of Tom Rich.
Tom Rich?
And
Tom Rich.
I don't really have anything to say tonight. I just have a lot to suggest.
Okay.
So you're on stage, and I'm just going to throw out the suggestion.
Very
First
good.
Of all, it's I just wanted to say, of course, it's the 10-year anniversary coming up of McLuhan's death. Actually, having died December 31st, 1980, it's interesting that you should be on the radio on CBC 10 years later.
Yes.
But this is something that I thought the listeners would be interested in. It's from December 28th, 1964. Notes on Burroughs by McLuhan. And it falls in line with the lot of that you've been saying with regard to the second lung that you mentioned a couple of weeks ago. But I'll throw this out and you can just bounce yourself off it.
Okay.
Today, men's nerves surround us. They have gone outside as electrical environment. The human nervous system itself can be reprogrammed biologically as readily as any radio network can alter its fare. Burroughs has dedicated Naked Lunch to the first proposition and Nova Express to the second. Naked Lunch records private strategies of culture in the electric age. Nova Express indicates some of the corporate responses and adventures of the subliminal kid who is living in a universe which seems to be someone else's insides. Both books are a kind of engineer's report of the terrain hazards and mandatory processes which exist in the new electric environment.
Is that it, Tom?
That's it for this section.
Well, that's from The Nation magazine, December 64, and Marshall McLuhan considered Burroughs continuing the work of James Joyce and Finnegan's Wake. And so he took Burroughs' books as challenges, and I have a copy of what Tom is reading. And if anybody wants some, come on down. It's an excellent review. But dealing with the words in the first part that Tom talked about, The Naked Lunch, he says, records the private strategies of culture in the electric age. Now, Naked Lunch was Burroughs' epitaph on his experience with junk, all right? The naked lunch on the end of a fork. And Marshall goes on later about what junk means, but it's interesting that there's a congressional testimony before Naked Lunch in the copy that I have, and then a foreword by Burroughs talking about apomorphine as the cure for heroin addicts. And he predicted the rise of the heroin problem in the 60s and 70s. It's interesting that Marshall calls that private strategies of culture in the electric age. In other words, medicinal strategies, like what Connie does at Doctors for Bob. That's a private response. That's dealing with individuals and their bodies. Right, Tom?
That's right.
Now, Nova Express, the next book, indicates some of the corporate responses and adventures of the subliminal kid who is living in a universe which seems to be someone else's insides. Now, that really resonates with my chart in The Perfect Pitch and in High Witness by Mail, because corporate responses, and Marshall has corporate in quotation marks, indicates mixed corporate media, the media archetypes in the global theater since 1945, their responses to the fact that they themselves are inside the electrical environment.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the subliminal kid would be the Antichrist, the master of both hardware and software media, all right? And Marshall often referred to the subliminal kid as Orpheus, the agent for tuning the sky. What would you say?
Tuning the planet.
And that is about the best that that the Secret Council 10 can do if they're pinks, is respond to the media archetypes in the global theater and their interplay recorded in their effects, the bloodstream being advertising. The anthropomorphic agent, the subliminal kid, Orpheus, can respond by tuning the effects. He responds to the effects. He tunes his responses to the effects created by the interplay of the corporate media. And it's interesting, Marshall says that the subliminal kid is living in a universe which seems to be someone else's insides. Now, the universe is a biological, God's first nature. Now, the universe is subsumed in the electrical environment. So the Antichrist would feel alienated and paradoxically would align himself with the previous first natural universe, maybe still competing with the creator of the first natural universe. He is in opposition on the universe's side against the electric environment, alienated, therefore thinks universe is in
is someone else's insides. That's what I find interesting, Tom.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's a very, very interesting and original taking the McLuhan and going beyond it to a point beyond McLuhan, which is really interesting.
Yeah, and I could follow that up in the third note that McLuhan has. He says, the logic, physical and emotional, of a world in which we have made our environment out of our own nervous systems. Burroughs follows this logic everywhere to the peripheral orgasm of the cosmos.
Now, of course, he's talking here about the fact that man provides, as he says, the sexual organs of the technological world, and that seems obvious to Burroughs, and sets the stage for his, and this is an interesting term, the biological theater, as he calls it in Nova Express.
Yeah, the biological theater, I think Burroughs is seeing the reverse image of McLuhan, whereas he sees the old natural limbs acting out as fragmented mechanical extensions on the global theater. Whereas Marshall saw them as an anthropomorphic content of the media archetypes theater.
Mm-hmm.
See what I mean?
Yeah. So, it would be interesting to push the next point.
Well, just before you do, I wanted to say this thing about the peripheral orgasm of the cosmos. That's continuing the thought from the third, the percept from the first note, where he's talking about the universe seems to be someone else's inside, talking about that first original nature, the cosmos. It's an orgasm. The universe itself has an orgasm, but it's peripheral, because first nature is put aside by man's second nature, the electric environment. That's why I think he says it's a peripheral orgasm of the cosmos, which is that would lead to Gnostic adventures, because people would realize reflexively that the cosmos was on a new plane, having had its orgasm. You see what I mean?
Yeah, okay.
Okay, so your point?
Well, no, just to build on that, Burroughs, the bottom line of Burroughs is that he's talking about within his books, he's talking about this new idea of the way in which man is evolving.
Yeah, which is what you said I was pointing out.
Exactly.
Yeah.
In other words, it's possible to develop an elaborate theory of the various media of communication in Darwinian terms of natural selection, where the media themselves can be viewed as the figure of the artificial extensions of our sensory existence.
Yeah, now that's what our caller, I think his name was Andrew, was bringing up last week. He got the insight from Bob Marshall at the Beehive that man's institutions and technological environments were the second nature. Now you can trace the revolution through man's history and study the gradients of response based on sensory profile of their interaction with each other. That's a Darwinian continuum, right?
That's right. Did you have anything else to add? I wanted to...
No, go on.
Something that also hit me that's interesting on that article that McLuhan wrote in 64. And it would be interesting to draw out the Mondo 2000 people.
Yeah.
Because they're McLuhan-esque in their approach, and one could find it of interest to think about cornering them on what McLuhan points out here on the sixth point, which is, and I'll read it out, because Mondo 2000 is sort of a drug-oriented...
retrieval of 60 psychedelia.
Right, retrieval mixed in with a new wave computer techno.
Well, their hero Terence McKenna, the psychedelic expert on the line of Tim Leary, a quiet, modest version of Tim Leary in the 80s, reviewed the letters of Marshall McLuhan, and he pointed out that. I can't remember. Continue talking, Tom. I'll get back to it.
All right. Burroughs disdains the hallucinogen.
Oh, okay. I got it. Okay. McKenna quotes Tim Leary that Leary was advised by McLuhan that his psychedelic revolution would not be effective, would not work, would not have a vast mass response until the computer became accessible to everybody in their own home. Therefore, you know, like hydraulic jacks pumped up on the addictive level of the cathode ray tube privately through the computer. So the Mondo 2000 guys are taking off from the computer revolution propagated by Leary in the 80s, adapting it to virtual reality, and therefore do replay the 60s, but with a more late 80s virtual reality high-tech Defense Department spinoff, Slant.
Yeah, but virtual reality, of course, is a somnambulistic response to having to keep up with further and further technological change and the effects of the scrubbing off of identity going inside more and more.
Right, read that point six that you were going to say.
Yeah, Burroughs disdains the hallucinatory drugs as providing mere, quote, content, unquote. The fantasies, dreams that money can buy, junk, in brackets heroin, is needed to turn the human body itself into an environment that includes the universe. The central theme of Naked Lunch is the strategy of bypassing the new electric environment by becoming an environment oneself.
You're asking me?
Yeah.
I'm in my day and age? No.
Okay, so would you say cocaine has had a longer... Do you see heroin taking over from cocaine?
No.
So you think heroin remains taboo?
I think really only in some circles heroin is accepted. It seems to be in the higher ups in the star system.
The ones who can afford the withdrawal from normal life.
But it still does achieve a certain status.
Yeah, to be able to handle heroin addiction.
Yeah.
So I think Marshall's on the right track. When you would move from LSD, I think maybe that's what I'm trying to say, is you'd move from these movie kind of kinetic drugs to that elitist of drugs, heroin, where you could, if you're a star and you have the whole world at your fingertip, all the old mechanical media, then what are you going to use as an antidote? You're going to have to put on and wear the whole universe. So heroin would service that need, right, Tom?
That's right.
Yeah. You program the sensory order of your own body as well as the reflections of that in your audience.
Yeah, and embodied within this, there's a lot of the strategies and antidotes that our society requires in order to keep in touch with what's going on and find a way of finding a space in which they can get rid of the dizzying effect of the speeded up technology and sit back and find a place for a room with a view. I'm reminded of that whole John Pix thing, the man who tried to beat the system but became it.
How did he do that? How did he try to beat the system?
He tried to beat the system by the system being the PhD system of Wisconsin University. He tried to read everything in the English language and summarize it and make notes on everything that had ever been written. And in that way, he attempted to beat the system by having read everything in the English language that had ever been written.
Yeah. And he didn't beat the system that way?
He didn't beat the system at all. He became the system. And, of course, I think McLuhan was talking about himself. He read everything. McLuhan had the ability, the marvelous human ability, which I think most people have never ever thought of because it's such an unfathomable task. It makes the Herculean task of cleaning the stables seem puny.
Yeah.
He read everything that had ever been written in the English language, Bob.
Yeah.
This is true.
Yeah.
And had decided what was noteworthy and what wasn't. And I think within the story, he was talking very much about himself, in that he probably, as a young man, tried to beat the system using his genius, only to find that there was a better thing to do, and that was become it. And I think he has become the system.
Wait a minute. I would say that he realized he became the system in the late 40s, early 50s when he started writing letters to Pound complaining that he'd been wasting his time reading all this English.
Yes.
Remember that? So that he always used John Pick as the guy who had the wife, kids, and mortgage, who maintained, merged with the system, and couldn't make the leap into the abyss that McLuhan did in the early 50s.
Mm-hmm.
And McLuhan then beat the system. He was seeing that he was becoming the system, but he beat the system.
Mm-hmm.
And he beat the system because he had his mortgage covered with his tenure at the University of Toronto. And he knew that that would lead to him, his image of what he had done, becoming the system. But he himself did not become the system. He beat it. But his image became the system.
Yeah, that's a good point. Yeah, his image became the system, but he beat it.
He didn't. He was a Menippean satirist all the way to the day he died.
And, of course, that's something that's coming up. This is the last show before the 10th anniversary. And I just thought I'd end off and say, you've had a tremendous year. I think we've all had a tremendous year. And we're looking forward to 1991 and hearing more of your percepts. And I'm looking forward to in the year ahead getting into some more interesting things. I think it's interesting to talk about Iraq. It's also interesting to talk back about what's going on here in Canada and to try and get some people's attention onto Confederation as a belief structure, how it was sold to the colonists, the word managers of British intelligence that created it. And I guess that at some point we can then move and once we've explained that, talk about that except for a generation apart. Are you going to go into hiding now, Bob?
Yep.
But except for a generation apart, the MERD managers who created that British Intelligence Confederation as a belief structure created Zionism as a belief structure. And that both Israel and Canada have a lot in common because they're both British colonies in disguise. And I guess that's a clothing that was sold to people for them to put on outside, given to them from outside, rather than a put on from the inside. And there's a lot there that we can get into in 1991.
Yeah, the fact that it was didn't come from within, came from without.
That's right.
Well, you're the one who mentioned Zionism. Zionism started off 100 years ago as a wonderful ideal. And remains for the global audience to decide where it's at today. You said it, I didn't say it.
Well, unfortunately, of course, the Jewish people, having been tremendously prejudiced and alienated and having all sorts of terrible things put against them, it was extremely easy for the word managers at British intelligence to take downtrodden people like that and sell them in this idea, and not realize. And of course, they had no other choice, emotionally and psychologically, as a collective group, but to grab onto it. And this is something that, in light of that, one has to ask why the people of Upper Canada, who weren't downtrodden and weren't in such a difficult situation collectively, why did they grab onto it and swallow it hook, line, and sinker in 1867?
Right, the Canadian concept.
That's right.
Well, you're Jewish, right? Personally.
That's right.
Okay, well, how do you as a Jewish person feel about the Zionist mandate?
Oh, I think that Jews around the world have to very seriously understand the way in which large wealthy organizations of people can prop up ideas and sell it to the mass, and the masses haven't got the ability because they're so busy doing other things to really look at it and examine it. They get swept up in the maelstrom, just like Edgar Allan Poe's Mariner.
Yeah.
And all of a sudden, it becomes a reality, and becomes a mask. And I think that we in Canada are starting to realize that Confederation, likewise, has been a tremendous mask. Brian Mulroney had to go back to the Queen to make the changes necessary to pass the GST. I mean, there's just no doubt that we've been a colony in disguise all these years, and the real question is, who has the colony been sold to? Who's the new owner? And where's the deed? And when did the title change hands? There's a lot of things of interest that the Canadians are going to be forced to look at. I think that the Quebecers are starting to realize that they're not happy with the new owners.
Okay. Thanks a lot, Tom.
Bye-bye.
Bye. Hey, McCullers?
Hello?
Yeah.
Hello, Robert.
Ed.
Hello, Michael.
Ed, you complained a few weeks ago that you were finding it hard to get on the show. You get on every week. How do you do it?
Oh, I was just petulant. There's just a couple of things. The thing about Kent, for people who are able to stay up later and hear the extended Club 22, he gets into some good jams. Like just having you in the studio as a silent partner.
Yeah.
It's very inspiring. He played a lot of William Burroughs last week, and it was quite a resonating thing for a couple of days. I just thought I'd mention that. It would be a shame to lose Kent. But the thing I wanted to approach was an observation made by one of the other holy offices, probably one of the most controversial of your holy offices, is Herbert W. Armstrong.
Yeah.
And Christmas is something he had his very strong opinions in the Worldwide Church of God, which he was the most,
Southern Ontario.
I guess he was the number one spokesman for that church.
Yes.
But first, we all feel alienated from Christmas. It's mutated so much since 1945. Saint Nicholas, it's hard to believe that patron saint of Russia has now been transformed into the most widely reproduced religious figure in the modern world. There's more images of Santa Claus than any other saint. And so Herbert W. Armstrong looked at this, and I think you referred to this in the beginning part of the show, Bob, that actually Christmas, the actual birth date of Christ, is much earlier. It's in early November, I believe.
No, I think the spring.
It's that early, eh?
Yeah, because he wouldn't come in the dead of winter when it's very cold and barren. He came in the spring when, as a symbol of life. Like Connie was born in the spring.
Well, Armstrong thought it was quite a scandal, I think, about the...
Yeah, he wouldn't celebrate Christmas.
Yeah, one of the earliest Christian Caesars gave in. People wanted to keep celebrating the winter solstice, which is coming up on us within 48 hours.
Yeah, Frank Zappa's birthday.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
So he's a born pagan.
Yes, he says he's a devout pagan.
So again, Herbert W. Armstrong thought by putting a Christian mask on a pagan ceremony, he thought he was just aghast at that.
Yeah, he was outraged.
I just wondered if because we... I just thought I'd point it out and see what resonates with Bob when we say that this kind of Christmas fraud we've been living through.
Well, December 25th is Nimrod's birthday, according to Herbert W. Armstrong.
Oh, Nimrod is a fallen angel?
No, he was, I think, the original city builder, way back there, 2000 B.C. or something. And it was his birthday, December 25th, which was a pagan ritual, and I guess it was Constantine, when he took over and adapted the true Christian church to the Roman Empire, he made the hidden content of it a pagan ritual reference point. And that's what Herbert W. Armstrong, who's a purist in these matters, objects to. And he says the true church was never part of the more mainstream churches, that it was sort of like a subgenius church out in the desert, on the edge, all through history. And one thing about Herbert is that the number 19 is very important. He sees evolution in 19-year cycles. So that's why we include him in the subgenius church. He was clued into the number 19. What do you think of that?
Oh, I'm... excuse me while I just stop spinning here. It's just you need a little dizziness at Christmas. It's like your show had a certain sonic mood of 15 minutes ago when Tom was talking. Excuse me. I can almost hear chestnuts roasting on the open fire.
And I secretly seeing Laura.
I slap my face for being Sam in school. But it is the most. Well, what? Yeah, multiple personality. Who mentioned that earlier?
Guelph,
because, as I told you once, I'm still partly a
million square miles of North America.
You're what?
Part of me, my conscience is a radical feminist.
Yeah.
Because I went steady, if that was possible in '70, to go steady with a feminist.
Yeah, the fact you've cited this twice, Edward, over the last month is important in you.
Yeah. But I'm also a paid-up member of the United Church of Canada, even though I haven't set foot in one for years. But isn't this a common condition we live in?
Yeah, Guelph was making a good point. Marshall McLuhan's buddy, Ted Carpenter, did a book with Marshall, and it was called They Became What They Beheld, and the last image is a young person, maybe a teenager, with a leafy mask over their face, over his or her face, and the caption is, "I contain multitudes." And this was the Guelph problem. We all have to deal with our multiple environments that we wear, which include millions of kinds of people, million archetypals of crowds, plus the old individual postures of mind. You know what I mean?
What comes to mind is, can each of us subgenii build our own personal pantheon of holy offices?
Well, there's nothing stopping you. I mean, who's going to stop you? The problem is, can you take that pantheon and get on the air like me? You'd have to apply to Mike, and maybe there would be better Bobs than me. I doubt it, but I'm willing to put it up to
raffle, or whatever you call, what do you call it, democracy, election? But then we'd have to have applications to who to be Mike. We have to have different Mike, right?
How do you
Mike,
say,
right?
I love you, yeah, to a teenager.
Yeah, it gets pretty sticky. So
yeah.
Stick with,
stick with the status quo. You know, we don't need to reinvent the wheel. You can use your own pantheon and private conversation. Do an anti-environment to me. Claim that the electric discarnate state is murder, and that you'd like to go back to the human scale and continue a non-electrified church. Start a private non-electrified church. That's the only strategy left for you.
There is a speaker's corner in City Hall Square. You can get up there and say anything you want, unless maybe...
Yeah, but those are people who are trying to tell you something. I'm not trying to tell you something.
Really?
No. Didn't you know that?
Well, what have I been listening to all these weeks?
A massage.
Oh.
This is homeopathy. This is injection. This is massage. This is alternative medicine.
Oh, Mike said it was, I think he said it was psychotherapy a couple of weeks ago. What did you call it, Mike?
Therapeutic. The best therapy in the world.
Yeah.
Well, that's massage. That's therapy. This is bloody therapy. It's a ritual. It's a religious ritual.
Oh, it is a ritual.
Yeah, and you can't have ritual and which has a point of view. Ritual doesn't have a point of view. It puts on the audience. Where is the audience? It's like what Tom said earlier. We don't, in a way, we
how do you say
put something on from the outside, but I try to create the environment that you are taking it out of yourself. I evoke it out of yourself.
I wish I could share the altar I built for the show tonight to tape it. The good old Iowa tape recorder needs parts. And as you know, Bob, I have some stumbling things going on with taping. You might know a few things about that.
Are you saying you're failing to tape the show tonight?
Oh, no, I'm taping it, but I had to get two radios. In fact, I borrowed a radio from the basement of the doctors for Bob Institute.
Yeah.
And just so you don't get the... And I put a little crude Sony right up to that radio. It's got a bass. Then I got another clock radio from one of the roommates. That's the treble. I put them in a box, an orange box. And to get a certain resonance, I wrapped it with an orange blanket in the orange box.
If you don't say it.
And, actually, it looks like three camels sleeping under these blankets just so I don't get room echoes.
So your taping may not be a perfect tape.
Well, I think it'll sound good. I tested it earlier with CBC.
Okay.
So anyway, enough of that. But it's a great altar. I'll have to maybe draw you a picture.
Yeah.
I had to put pillows on the west wall so it wouldn't wake up the neighbors.
Well, let me read you the last note 11 of 11 notes by McLuhan on Burroughs. McLuhan says, it is amusing to read reviews of Burroughs that try to classify his books as non-books or as failed science fiction. Marshall says that's amusing. It is a little like trying to criticize the sartorial and verbal manifestations of a man who is knocking on the door to explain that flames are leaping from the roof of our home. Burroughs is not asking merit marks as a writer. Neither am I, as a communicator. He is trying... That's me saying that. Burroughs is not asking merit marks as a writer. He is trying to point to the shut-on or off-on button of an active and lethal environmental process. Burroughs is arguing that the power of the image to beget image and of technology to reproduce itself via human intervention is utterly in excess of our power to control the psychic and social consequences. Now, it's
how do you say
put something on from the outside... So he says just before that, he quotes Burroughs, where Burroughs is talking about apomorphine. Apomorphine is no word and no image. It is simply a question of putting through an inoculation program in the very limited time that remains. Word begets image, and image is virus. And I recall in C. Callan's program notes, Ken Perry has for his Club 22, he says, what is it,
as the world
sound begets image, and image begets the question mark. Was Kant quoting Burroughs? Word begets image, and image is, well, Burroughs says, virus. So maybe we figured out what Kant was about.
Give me time to come up with
on his last show.
Bridge is nice. Hope it makes lots of ice.
Hey?
I'm still spinning. Okay. Hopefully I discover if I go up to the altar close, so I get this new effect. Listen.
That's not you, Mike?
That was me.
Oh, okay. Merely to be in the presence of any machine, like your tape machine, a replica of our body or faculties, is to close with it. So that's a sign, a sound symbol of you closing with it. All right? When you go close to it. Our sensory ratios shift at once with each encounter with any fragmented extension of our being. This is a nonstop express of innovation, the Nova Scotia Express, that cannot be endured indefinitely. It is the medium that is the message, says Marshall, because the medium creates an environment that is as indelible, you can't erase it, as it is lethal. To end the proliferation of lethal new environmental expression, Burroughs urges a huge collective act of restraint, as well as a non-closure of sensory modes. So he's saying that Burroughs was advocating media ecology in the 60s. Okay, you got to go.
Nice talking to you.
Okay.
Best of the season, Michael.
Thanks, Edward.
Bob.
Okay, Edward.
And to all the audience.
God bless. Thanks, Bob.
And the check wise.
Okay, and you are listening to the Church of the Subgenius show. My name is Michael Dyer with J.R. Bob Dobbs. And this is the last show of 1990. And the number here is 595-1478, 595-1655 also. So let's go right to another call.
Okay.
Do you need to take a break?
Oh, no, Mike. I'm ready for more callers.
Okay.
Oh!
He's gone. Okay, sorry.
Any more?
Not for the moment.
Okay. Well, I think we should continue our profile of the Anglo-American oil companies, since we heard from the exes the general outline of their motives. Is it okay with you, Mike?
We just got the line back. Want to try
okay.
To
we'll do British Petroleum later.
Hello, Sikela.
Is that you doing
no,
it?
No.
Okay. We'll start off with British Petroleum, as Mike keeps his eye on that little red light. Is it there? Okay. This is the second of the Anglo-American oil companies. All right. British Petroleum, the former Anglo-Persian oil company, has not lost its relation to the British government despite the controversial 1987 privatization of its shares.
Bob.
You going to call it?
The line's back again.
Okay.
That's right. Good. Hit the button. We'll see if it's there.
Hello? Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. British Petroleum.
Bob, I'm going to ignore the phone for
okay.
a while.
Okay, I've got something to say while
right.
you ignore it. Okay, so despite the controversial 1987 privatization of its shares, British Petroleum owns the Brit Oil Plc. I don't know what that is, Brit Oil Plc, and is the largest oil producer in the North Sea. In a peculiar double cross, British Petroleum and the British government forced the Kuwait Investment Office in 1989 to sell back 790 million shares in British Petroleum to lower the Kuwait Investment Office holdings in British Petroleum to 9.9%. What's that got to do with Kuwait, right, in the present situation? According to this thing here, the British government forced the Kuwait Investment Office to sell back those shares. The Kuwait government, on a confidential request from the Bank of England and the British government, had agreed to buy the shares in the British Petroleum privatization sale, which happened to occur in the aftermath of the October 1987 stock market crash, in order to stabilize the British market and British Petroleum itself. The Kuwait Investment Office held a stake of 22% as a result. British, that must have been like the sucker figure, right? British Petroleum is the largest producer of oil from the rich Alaska North Slope in the United States and controls 30% of all North Sea production. The largest shareholder in British Petroleum today remains Her Majesty's Government of Great Britain with 25.2% of all shares. The Kuwait Investment Office, as mentioned, retains 9.9%, and Morgan Guaranty Trust Company of New York holds 8.5%.
Diane?
The directors of British Petroleum, the second most influential oil multinational in the world, they're saying Royal Dutch Shell is the most influential, with gross sales in 1989 above $60 billion, include, here are the directors, Sir John Baring, chairman of the influential Baring's Merchant Bank and a director of the Bank of England, Patrick Sheehy, chairman of British American Tobacco, or BAT Industries, Sir Lindsay Alexander, director of Lloyd's Bank, Sir Campbell Fraser, director of BAT Industries also, Louis T. Preston, chairman of J.P. Morgan & Company. Now, those are the boys we're dealing with that the exes told us. Take a call, Mike. Does that hang up again?
We'll try again. Hello? Hello, CKLM? Hello?
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 You're on.
Hi. Bob.
Yeah?
I wanted to ask you about your prediction about the exes' prediction that AIDS would be wiped out and it would be announced by the end of this year.
Yeah, the announcement, as I announced on fundraising, October 17th, I think. Am I on, Mike? Yeah. On October 17th, I announced here during fundraising that we have the AIDS cure here in Toronto. And it was to be announced in December, but a couple of little problems happened, which I can explain later when it is announced officially in January. You can look, wait another month. The Iraqi war may drown it out a little bit, the Gulf crisis, but it is here. It's being used. And the exes were right. It was They were talking about what we're going to be announcing in January. It's just that a little unforeseen human problem came up with the statistics that they couldn't have the press conference this month. And another actual human problem came up. So it will be announced in January, but the results were in 6 months ago. It's just a matter of organizing the proper people to announce it, proper level of press conference, media coverage. And it was supposed to happen this month. It will come. You are safe. You can throw away your condom.
Well, no, I'm not worried about that. It's just that, you know, there's only like less than 10 days left before the end of the year, so...
Well, the point is that it was officially proven this summer, all right? Then you got to take several months to organize with the university medical journals and feed them the statistics so that it's accepted on that academic level, we'll say. And then you make your public announcement. The public announcement was scheduled for December because of unforeseen problems. Remember, the Exus made the prediction in January. And they said it would be at the end of the year. I would say that January is near the end of the year. So it'll happen. Don't worry about it. They predicted this back in 1987. They predicted the technique, and they predicted when it would surface, which was the summer of 88. They're right on that. And if you don't believe me, wait till January, and you'll understand even more.
Yeah, another thing, too, I was going to say to you, I think that George Bush is going to wimp out and that they aren't going to attack the Iraqis. And all of a sudden they're going to come up with some crazy solution or something. They're probably going to give them that oil field that they want right in the middle there, right?
Well, you might know more than me. But I don't think so.
Why?
Well, I'm involved in this whole crisis, and I know what's going to happen. I create half of the problems myself. So you're talking to the person who is going to be the trigger man in this situation. So should I accommodate my power to your prediction, or should I go with a lot of other more powerful people? That's the question, right?
Right.
If you can prove to me privately somehow that I should heed your call when to pull the trigger or not to pull the trigger, that's what you have to do.
I think you should pull the trigger on January 22nd.
Yeah, I think it might be very close to that day.
Yeah.
Okay.
Okay.
Anything else you want to talk? Any other topics?
Not right now. If you'll like it, I'll call back.
Yeah, great. You have a name?
Jason.
Thanks. You were quoted. Did you hear the poem at the beginning? The guy talked about Jason, the image of the multi-faced entity.
Yeah, it is true. I'm a Gemini, so I was born on the cusp between Gemini and Cancer. So.
Yeah, yeah. You mean June 21st?
Yep.
That's Dr. Beter's birthday. You're in good company.
Oh, neat.
Yeah. 1921, June 21st. Congratulations. That means you should do some extra study of Dr. Beter's holy office.
And how would I find out about that?
Give me a call later.
Okay.
Privately.
Same number?
Or 657-8040.
4-657-8040?
657-8040.
657-8040. Okay.
Yeah. Okay. Thanks. Bye.
Okay.
Okay, Mike?
To keep things moving along.
Yeah.
It's a quarter after one. We have 45 minutes left in the final show of 1990. We're talking about the past year.
Yes, we're reviewing the events.
Reviewing the year of 1990. No need to watch the McNeil Lair report tomorrow night. Hello, CPLN.
Hello.
Hi.
Hey, how's it going?
Good.
I think it's time we get into Dave Ayres' topic.
Hey.
Spirituality versus sensory closure.
Well, okay.
You want me to go first?
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah, Dave, he's had this on the agenda for about three shows, and we never got to it. Basically, the quote you gave was that media deal with sensory closure and generally external agents of sensory closure. Isn't that what you said?
McLean was saying that it closes your personal world and opens you in a sort of vulnerabilizing way to the external nervous system.
That's right.
And that it deadens that's why we become zombies, right?
Yeah.
But the flip of that is meditation, where you do that on purpose, consciously.
The meditation where you go inner.
Yeah.
Okay. Now here's the point. The
if you love.
I think spiritual is a kind of detachment. It's not a Gnostic detachment, which believes that there is an area of spirit that's separate from the world of matter.
Mm-hmm.
It's a detachment in the interval between spirit and matter.
Which is image or the senses.
Right.
Yeah.
It is a detachment from the senses. Now, here's what's the crux of the problem today. We've extended the electric image, the interior space. Traditionally, detachment came from meditating and exploring inner space.
Yeah.
Now, when we extend our inner space electrically, that's why it's not necessarily an externalization. It is a further interiorization of our senses, interiorization of our inner life. So how do you get detachment? Just let me say this question.
Yeah.
How do you get detachment in the traditional way of exploring inner space in an environment of inner space? That's the trick. That's the new Zen problem, to get that spiritual detachment.
Well, that's why the Zen monks sit in front of the television and meditate.
Nah, I don't think that would work.
Too simple, that is too simple.
Yeah, yeah, that wouldn't work.
But I can't see it being too different because...
here's the thing. When you meditate in front of the TV image, you are resonating with the natural reflex effect of the TV image, which causes meditation in the bosom. You know, the image in the Toronto Star of TV replacing people's heads? Most people don't know that the television replaces your guts. Internal. It includes your head, but you have to have the screen, the box, which is from the image from Adbusters magazine. You have to have the screen basically around your whole body. But to emphasize the kinetic, proprioceptive, and internal visceral nature of TV, you should have the TV screen around your torso. All right?
Yeah.
The eye and ears are puny compared to the torso effect. Now, you are already meditating in your bosom when you're watching TV. So the Zen monk who meditates in a meditative posture with the TV, he is merely mirroring the TV effect.
Yeah.
Now, mirroring is a visual bias. You've got to learn to echo also. So how do you echo the TV effect as well as mirroring it?
Well, maybe because it's already complete. It's already happened. So echoing it is just being aware of something that's already taken place.
What has already happened?
The future. Whatever the final result of technology is already understood.
Right. And how does that relate to echoing?
That you meditate on the echoes of the future resonating right now, and that's how you learn.
But see, the electric environment already does that, puts you in touch with all past and all presents. In other words, all these mystical descriptions describe the immediate effect of television, which has happened in the world since 1950.
You were talking about...
Okay, so how do you detach yourself from the tactile bias? That's the question. We'll call that meditative inner space. How do you detach yourself from the spiritual?
The first time I ever listened to you, you were talking to Dave from Baldwin Foods.
Yeah, and he had trouble with this problem.
Yeah, me too. But he... I just lost what I was going to say.
Maybe it was what I was saying. It's about how do you detach yourself from the tactile interval? Because that's the bias of the electric television space.
Right. So you're holy offices, and he was saying what makes them so special, and you said because I'm only something about 4 nanoseconds, and I'm on to the next one that quick.
Right. The conceptual level of the holy offices cannot be really seen or classified because I move through them that quickly.
Yeah. And I was just that relates to how when the Buddha attained enlightenment. That I was just thinking, man, that's a long period of time as far as if you're aware of every particle of being in the universe simultaneously. 5 nanoseconds is an eternity.
Yeah.
But I would just think that one's perception could certainly encompass all of this stuff and still be detached from it, still be in a bubble. I don't know if that's the goal, really. To be
right. We also got to analyze what we mean by detachment. Because you have to erase every detached plateau you think you've arrived at.
Right.
Because only the hand that writes, or only the hand that erases, writes the true thing. Only the soul that erases experiences the true thing. So I'm saying you've got to use a new metaphor, which is a metaphor of a plateau, to express that final erasing of the tactile bias. We're going into a newly religious spiritual age.
Yes.
Now, that is just the conventional situation over the next 200 years. To be truly enlightened, you must be detached from your time, from the conventional wisdom. So what wisdom are you going to put on when everybody's spiritual? So that you can be detached from it. In a sense, detached means not embedded.
Yeah.
That's the question. Certainly conceptual maneuvers won't work.
No, that's for sure.
Yeah, and perceptual...
Do you find that you've indulged in conceptual maneuvers more than you might like sometimes?
No,
you can't stop your mind from doing that stuff?
No. See, that's where you're resonating with the point Tom Rich brought up, is that Marshall studied everything for 30 years. He read.
And nothing worked.
Yeah, he realized that there was a whole universe he was missing. So he broke into percept. Now, I never spent much time in conceptual reality, but I've had so much time in slack that, and I'm 68 years old, so that I have a quite encyclopedic containment of conceptual knowledge, but that was just through lazy browsing over 60 years, right?
Yeah.
So, but I'm an expert on perceptual reality. That's why I have such a good relationship with Connie. I'm very good at percept.
No, okay, I'm not sexy. I think we've brought that to a peak. Let's go on to the next one.
Good.
Okay, now...
Are there twin peaks?
Yeah,
the, imagine
Connie has twin peaks.
That's what I was just going to think.
Yeah, Connie's in her bosom today.
Yeah. Now, I was just... You were talking to the other guy about you give a massage.
Who did I say that to?
To
Ed, yeah, right.
Yeah. You're not trying to tell anybody anything. You're giving a massage.
Yeah, I'm dealing with percepts.
Yeah, which is nice. You know, and it is like, it's nice to be reminded that that's what it is, so you're not always trying to figure everything out.
Right.
Because, you know, when you're talking to Tom Rich, that's pretty intimidating, scholarly stuff, you know, for a lot of people.
Right, that's Mike's role. Mike's role is to remind you of the other levels of sound to massage you, while you might tend to evoke a conceptual response when you listen to Tom Rich.
Yeah, he's the body and you guys are the mind.
Yeah.
Fantastic.
Yeah. Now this is what you just said was important. I massage, but I'm not massaging you to lull you into narcosis.
Right.
So how can I massage you to get you out of the massage? That's the real dilemma I'm dealing with.
Get me out of which massage?
Of the tactile massage you're in generally.
Yes.
And then I massage you as an ersatz, artificial anti-environment here, but I'm not massaging you to have you merge with things. I want to massage you into a state of detachment. So our media ecology. What an awesome task.
Well, it has to do with pain that we brought up a couple.
Yeah.
It has to do with massaging pain. Points of pain.
It's almost like I try to create temporary points of pain and then blunt them at the same time.
But the perception I've had several times that I've never voiced to you is that Connie's a doctor, and you seem to have a lot of qualities that exceptional cancer patients have or good patients have. And good patients are people that outlive their prognosis when they've been diagnosed as having a terminal disease or whatever. Are very stubborn and independent and have their own points of view and don't believe anything anybody tells them and, you know, has their own, you know, and the person that lives the longest in this culture, people that live the longest are conductors. And I thought, that's sort of what you're doing. You're not trying to tell us anything. You're simply conducting.
That's right. I'm orchestrating. I'm Orpheus. Yes. I'm the subliminal kid, as we said earlier, quoting Burroughs, tuning the sky in the discarnate mixed corporate media interplay.
Is that programming sensory order?
Yeah.
Yeah, that's the conductor.
Yeah.
So live long and prosper.
Thank you.
Yeah, you're welcome.
Yeah, let's not end there.
No, okay, two more things.
And that's what I do is the pink form of media ecology, the pink form. See, Connie deals with the private strategies of culture in the electric age. Nova Scotia Express, Burroughs' next book, indicates some of the corporate responses and ventures of the subliminal kid. All right. Oh, I wanted to tell you, you know, your former, you worked at NOAA's. Yeah. Apparently you don't work there anymore, but there was a guy named Edmund who worked there.
Hmm.
Okay. You can ask the NOAA people. You know where Edmund is right now?
Where?
He has spent the last couple of months in Garrett Dean's company.
Interesting.
He stumbled on one of the sacred holy offices that nobody here in Toronto has access to. He, having worked at NOAA's, I think he was a produce manager, accidentally found Garrett.
Well, I'll have to follow that one out.
Yeah, you checked that out.
I know anything about that.
Yeah, no, you know some of the people. They might know.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay.
The Exus didn't say a word about my tree. I thought that was extremely interesting. Healing
they just bold from their point of view.
Say that again?
It's bold. It's bull data.
Well, why would they not just come in and say that? Like, they were really mum on it.
Well, they're sensitive people. The people who, Benjamin Cream and them, have the right to go around living that fantasy.
Yeah, okay.
And they're, I don't know if you would say ethical, but they're aesthetic. They don't want to create too many bad vibrations. That's why Milton Cooper is an idiot. You know, he's warning us of these aliens coming to invade us. And
Diane?
The Exus, who are the ones really are here and coming, they're very sensitive.
Listen, I saw their designs in the cross circles. I had no idea they were so elaborate. Beautiful stuff.
Yeah, it's not made by weather patterns or farmer hoaxers.
Boy,
it's real.
Boy, it sure is real. I mean, it's got that dose of authenticity to it.
Yeah, where'd you see it? In the Circular
this
Evidence?
Omni.
What?
This month's Omni magazine.
Oh, they got them, eh? There's two books. One of them's at the world's biggest bookstore. I saw their Circular Evidence, which is beautiful photos from a few years ago. And the newest one is called Crop Circle Enigma. Just came out. It's very important.
Wow,
beautiful picture.
Okay. Did you like my message, Bob, the St. Canada teacher?
Oh, from Radio Air First?
Yeah, did you hear that, Dave?
No, I didn't, but Mike, I recognized his Air First, and
okay,
Mike did too, right, Mike? You didn't hear the original. No, that was good. Like, did you make a collage?
Yeah, I was just taping it for fun, and then that came up, so I made the collage.
Basically, they're doing a Twin Peaks takeoff that Bob caused all of Mulroney's problems? Is that what they were doing?
Bob Ray, yeah.
Oh, Bob Ray.
Yeah.
They're playing it on Bob Ray.
Yeah, he actually he was the guy playing the piano. And he made a surprise appearance at the end, and he was quite funny.
Bob Ray was on the show.
Yeah.
So they got the right province, wrong Bob, right?
Exactly.
Well, what you picked out was great. Bob with the music.
Yeah, that was cute. Anyways, good to talk to you.
Yeah, I don't know. You see, what you raised, we got into enough to make you see the question, right?
Yeah, I can listen to the tapes and...
Yeah, the spiritual is not what it used to be. Just like the future ain't what it used to be. The spiritual ain't what it used to be.
Well, okay, give me a call sometime.
Okay.
Okay. Bye.
Is that okay for you, Mike?
Oh, it was good for me. That was a good call.
Okay.
Good seeing you from Dave.
Yeah, Dave Ayer. Oh, he doesn't mind his name. A-Y-R-E, which is like Rai. You know, it changes the letters around. You get Airhead or Air Discarnate. A-Y-R-E. A-I-R-E. Irish, you know, Scottish. There's a lot in that. David Ayer. And David is an important holy office. David Worcester of Cosmic Awareness. So I hope David Ayer isn't in the phone book so people don't harass him. But felt nice to get through his problem. And his solution is in the problem, always.
Yes. Yes.
Are we any more calls? Yes.
Lady, we picked up this guy hanging around your house.
Officer, this is ridiculous. This is my own house.
That right, lady?
The brown suit looks familiar.
Myra, this is no joke.
Any of you kids recognize this guy?
Tell the nice policeman who I am, Georgie.
I'm Jeffrey.
Okay, let's go.
But wait, I can explain. It's all a mistake.
Ever get the feeling you're not spending enough time with your family? Give them everything. Give them your time. A thought from the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints.
Thanks, Mike.
Hello.
Hi.
Hi.
Yes, Bob.
Yeah.
I'm calling about the...
owl?
No, not this time. This is Howard calling. Not about the owl this time.
You said Howard?
Yeah.
Oh, you gave your first name. Great.
Great. Well, I forgot to last time.
Yeah. Did you talk about the elections three or four shows ago? The local elections?
Yeah.
Talked about the mafia running your local NDP neighborhood?
That was interesting.
Yeah,
no,
was...
the liberals.
Yeah, that was you.
Yeah.
Yeah, I recognize you. Okay.
This time I'm calling about Zionism.
Oh, yeah, that's a hot topic.
Yeah, well, you want to wrap things up.
Who, I do?
Yeah, for the year.
Oh, okay, yeah.
And I don't think it's been dealt with right.
Okay, do it.
It seems that you're waiting for the Jews to call and
yeah.
tell you about it.
Well, Tom is Jewish. He just recognizes it's very hard to deal with, but he tried to, he approached it in a way
he was talking about the English maneuvers.
Right.
And the English were very wrapped up in something. Well, they were involved, of course. They took over from the old Turkish Empire.
Yeah, 100 years
collapsed.
Ago.
And they were also very involved in something else called the National Identity Movement.
Yeah, British Israelites.
Well, wasn't just Israel. There was a guy named Garibaldi.
Yeah.
And he went around Europe stirring up, well, I think mostly Christians. He unified Italy.
Yeah.
And I don't know.
He was a Freemason. He was part of the Mazzini Grand Orient Gang.
Well,
which would be linked to England?
If you're going to say it was Israel, you can say it was Italy, too.
Okay.
And he also went to England, where he was extraordinarily popular among the masses. And even today in English gardens, they have statues of Garibaldi. That's the guy they've got in the statues.
Right.
That's him. And then there was another guy called Bismarck. And he helped unite Central Europe.
Yeah.
As Germany. And this national identity movement was basically a European movement.
Okay.
The Jews being there picked up on it, and this national identity movement spread and spread. But at the time, the Jews were having a very hard time in Europe.
Yeah.
Because the left versus right, right versus left struggle, which went on for, well, a long time. It started the last century.
Yeah, I guess after the Congress of Vienna.
Yes, it was that far back, but I know that it was pretty bad for the Jews, especially at the very beginning of this century.
Yes.
And they still could escape. And then especially after a Jew helped them win the British war, win World War One, they gave them promises, but then they really preferred to go for the nobility, like the Egyptian nobility.
Who did?
The British.
preferred?
They seem to go with nobility, don't they?
Right, the British citizen?
Well, the British government.
Right, they go with nobility. Now, how does that relate to how...
They cared about more than even their entire province. These people were going all the way, and they cared about what was happening in the entire country. And this is like one step away from world consciousness.
Yeah.
Which they're just letting us in on now, as you've explained a number of times.
Yeah.
So I think 100 years ago, this was a very high ideal.
Yes.
That one could care about the entire vast country.
Yeah. So you, when you say national identity, you don't mean that as a logo or some movement. You mean as a general syndrome.
No, I think it started locally in Europe, and it spread, and it spread. Today there are people in northern Iran and northern Iraq, I forget their name, they're the people who are gassed. I remember the media at first reported that the Iranians were gassing the people in northern Iran who were helping the Iraqis, and then they really got down on the Iraqis who were gassing the people in
Kurds.
The Kurds. Yeah. They want their own country, and it has spread and spread all the way to Oka.
Right, this is
it's the same phenomenon.
Yeah.
It just took a long time to get out of Europe and to get all the way to the entire world.
Well, one of the main points is that the electric environment fractalizes the former huge national groups, the traditional West, you know, imperial powers. The electric environment fractionalizes them so that the previously unnationalized groupings have room to move into national size now, or national identity. So the electric environment is evoking these groups like Kurds having a sense of national identity. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, and I think that a lot of different people are at different stages of being westernized.
Yeah. So what were you saying? I want to get this point about the British did not keep up to their promises with the Jews after World War I. What's your point there?
Well, I really don't know much about that. I really wanted to talk about the national identity movement. It wasn't a Jewish movement. It was a European movement, and it went from Europe to Oka.
Yeah.
And the Jews, being in Europe, caught up on it early, and they were in a position where they really had to escape. They had gone as far north into northern Europe as they could, and in southern Europe they were getting slaughtered early this century. And, well, they needed a place to escape at the same time as Europe was going into national awareness as opposed to world awareness, which is happening 100 years later.
Yeah, I think, like I said earlier...
The British were really aware of Britain, too.
Yeah, well, I said earlier, Zionism started off as a wonderful idea.
But it wasn't especially a Jewish idea.
What was it?
It was a British idea. It was the unification of Italy. It was the unification of Germany.
So you're saying Garibaldi was a key influence in the Zionist movement?
The Jews were just a small minority taking part in the movement of... The movement of national awareness, as opposed to world awareness 100 years later.
What nation did Garibaldi represent?
Well, I'm told that he did unify the provinces into Italy, into a country.
Yeah.
So there's more than one country involved. There's Israel. Italy wasn't even a country.
So the Freemasons
This was a big, big European phenomenon. And tens of thousands of people showed up wherever he went.
Okay, so the Freemasons out of Britain used Garibaldi as an example for a national identity impulse. Now the Freemasons want a world government, or everybody think that way. The challenge for the Freemasons is they have to deal with the rising national identity aspirations of those cultures that never had it 100 years ago or 50 years ago. There's the dialectic. There's the problem, right? The Freemasons want us to accept world consciousness, yet because it's the national structure is broken down for the global Freemasons, then they have to operate on the world stage. But the pre-industrialized cultures want to move to the national level.
Yeah, they're 100 years behind, but they're moving up very, very quickly. I noticed how quickly the United States became anti-American, and then the rest of the world followed so quickly.
The United States became anti-American?
Yeah, with the 60s.
Yeah, the citizens.
Yeah.
And
the social, well, the media.
Yeah. So where that brings in Dublin's point, he says the American dream is still a viable archetype that will be a salvation, a kind of salvation for people, even as we move into this global theater. Have you heard him talk about that?
Yeah, but I don't understand that.
Yeah, maybe he could elaborate on that a little more. So, yeah, should we go to another caller? Or do you want to wrap up? Do you want to say something anymore?
I could mention something else.
Yeah, go ahead.
There's something a little bit controversial. I know I've heard a number of theories about AIDS and where it came from.
Yeah.
And there's something that I just never hear. I think it was a couple of weeks ago somebody asked who could be having sex with monkeys. That sounds like Sodom and Gomorrah.
Yeah, that was kind of Frank Mondia.
Zappa asked who.
Yeah. Who's cloaking the monkeys? He used to say.
Well, they were in New York City at the big parties, the fets. I know somebody who was at them. And apparently there are these monkeys who can do it dozens of times a night.
And people were pluking them?
I think they were being done by the monkeys. These monkeys can go at it all night.
I see. Well, that's a new twist.
And they had more than one monkey at these big parties, which were only, I think the Toronto bathhouse party scene was only a shadow of what went on in New York.
Is that right? So could you prove that? Do you have any evidence?
Well, I know somebody who I've known all my life who was there and saw it.
And you would trust them?
They told me that before I even heard of GRIDS.
Yeah.
And GRIDS was before AIDS.
Yeah. So there was.
He didn't have any reason. I don't even know if he'd heard of GRIDS.
Right. Okay, well, that's something...
There's no monkey connection anywhere.
Well, the AIDS virus was in nature before certain elements got ahead of it and manufactured it. The AIDS virus didn't come from the green monkey in the way that we know it today. It came from the lab. It was a viral debilitant, which meant it was designed for biological or chemical warfare to inflict on a population, have them experience a weakened immune system temporarily for a short period of time. They get the local diseases. They're weakened. They can't fight. You move in and take over, and you don't have dead people because the virus is designed to mutate and become benign. And then a few weeks later, the sick enemy victims of your attack are ready to carry on as your slaves. And therefore, you don't have the problem of putting in new workers after you've killed the enemy nation. So it was an evolution in warfare. It was a viral debilitant. And that's why the AIDS virus is going to be weaker and weaker over the 90s. You won't get as sick from it because it is going through the mutation of HIV-3, HIV-4, HIV-5. These mutations were programmed into the original virus, and it got out of hand, and it's going through a 28-year cycle. That's what really happened, and that'll come out over the next, I guess, 12 months, next year.
What's really happening is we're hearing so little about what goes on in bacterial warfare research.
And what?
There's nothing for the general public to... They just don't hear about it, and they can't fantasize about it. If they don't hear about it, it's like the big lie.
It's a hidden ground.
Like if there's nothing happening, I mean zero, nothing happening according to the...
Well, we try to generate some fantasies over it, because we try to deal with the hidden ground here, and that definitely is a part of the hidden ground. So, okay, we got to go, Howard.
Thank you.
Okay,
bye.
You're welcome. Thanks.
Sorry, I just wanted to... we've got another caller on the line.
Okay.
It's about 1:45.
Who's subbing in for Kent tonight, do you know?
Ron.
That guy?
Yeah.
Okay. Right. So at 5:02, we got to put him on.
Oh, right. Yeah. So essentially about 10 minutes left in the show, Church of the Subgenius, and we're touching upon topics that have concerned you, the listener, the past year. This is our last show for 1990.
A review of those topics.
When we're back in 2 weeks, it will be 1991.
3 weeks.
3 weeks? Oh,
yeah.
You're taking 2 weeks off.
3 weeks, yeah. January 9th, we'll be back.
Thanks for telling me. Okay.
Okay. All right.
My name is Michael Dyer. With me is J.R. Bob Dobbs, and let's go to another caller. Hello.
Hello. Hello, Bob.
Yeah, you going to answer that caller?
Yeah, I was preoccupied while he was talking. What was that about the bathhouses?
He said he has a friend from New York, or was in New York, and saw people being, pluked by monkeys, Mike, basically? And the monkeys could go on all night long, so you get a lot of...
Well, for Christ's sake. You mean, I read a story like that once about a... Oh, no, I don't want to talk about it. It's written by a woman, anyway.
This guy wants you to explain. What was the point you wanted to explain, Mike? It's something that you...
No, I caught that.
American archetype. Would you explain that to him?
You mean a variation? Yeah, okay.
Of the American dream as a very potent force, even into the future.
Yeah, because for a couple of reasons. The, I could start right on that. But what you said about the AIDS virus, I understood that. You were saying that because it was, if you're correct, and it was created in a laboratory,
yeah,
right, then it's taken out of its natural context where it would be a mutable thing. It would just change a little as it went along, right?
Yeah, it was designed to change over a span of period, you know.
Yeah, take a look at viruses. Take a look at birds and animals and fish. We change, but it takes quite a while for us to change. Us big creatures, right?
Yeah.
But little viruses, being so extremely simple, change much more quickly than we do.
Yeah.
So within a human lifetime, you know, a virus could go through a rate of change that might be the equivalent of human ancestors like apes. All of a sudden, you get humans like humans. But it might do that in 50 years. It might take us a million years.
So. Yeah.
Okay. So that's the common cold virus. Its natural condition is to undergo rapid change. And then what you're saying is exceedingly simple, and that's why I noticed it, that if the AIDS virus, in fact, was created in a laboratory, and this guy is saying that they were boffing monkeys, is that what he said?
Yeah, he said it's at parties.
Okay, so that's one theory. And your theory is that it was made in a laboratory. But if it was made in a laboratory, then it was fixed in an artificial form for a specific artificial, unnatural purpose, right?
Yeah.
So what you're saying is time is the enemy of the AIDS virus as we know it. That the longer it's out there, the more it does what any virus does and changes, just like the common cold virus.
Yeah, well, it's going through its program design. See, what happened when they implemented it as an experimental test in the late 70s in Chad, Nigeria, it mutated from the first phase into the next a lot more violently and faster than they predicted. They probably imagined like a two-week phase of mutation, and it mutated so violently, got out of control, that it was on a 28-year cycle. And the first few mutations were very lethal to the human
organism.
Why
does it live in the monkey? Like, why didn't they just kill off all the monkeys 1,000 years ago?
I don't know.
Maybe because it doesn't have anything like a severe effect on the monkey in its natural form as it has on humans in its new form, right?
Yeah.
So maybe...
Or maybe it's not as virulent as a genetically manipulated virus.
Well, a diseased organism that's too virulent is going to kill itself off because it's going to kill its host off too. Like, there's a mathematical imbalance there. A diseased organism that's too powerful would, in theory, kill off its host victims, right? Like, diseased organisms need... The malaria. That the life cycle of the little organism that causes malaria, it needs blood in order to live on this earth. It has to live in blood, right? So malaria keeps you alive in a debilitated state for a long, long time. That's good for the parasitic organism, or the organism that's using your blood as a medium to breathe in, or whatever it's doing. It's good for it, for you to stay alive and sick for a long time. If you die right away, there's no future in it. Any bug that kills you in order to live off you isn't going to eat off you very long, is it?
No.
So what you're really saying is that there might be a mathematical end to the AIDS virus, that its very power is going to legislate against it.
Yeah, okay.
So I just thought it was interesting.
Okay, to the mayor. Oh.
Okay, the thing about the other thing is this. That last caller was right. First of all, remember the First World War was started by the assassination of the Grand Duke?
Yes.
He was assassinated by a local yokel from the Balkans, from one of those little countries, right?
Yeah.
Young guy with oversimplistic revolutionary ideas. Okay, the important point is that individual was caught, and he was not executed. The reason he was not executed was even back 80, 90 years ago, they were so civilized in the Austro-Hungarian Empire that they recognized that a man who acted from political motives and who was a teenager or whatever the story was with this individual didn't deserve the death penalty. They had a very civilized and humane approach to handing out the death penalty.
They understood idealism.
They were practicing it. Like, it's very common for us to look back 100 years and say that all societies were very simple in those days. But that's just utter nonsense. Japanese society wasn't, the Austro-Hungarian Empire wasn't, even the Russians, who were pretty crude, weren't all that crude. See what I mean? Like, human beings have been sophisticated for an awful long time. So, and I just bring up this example because it's a startling example. There's an individual who started the First World War, and he was wrong. He was really wrong. He killed somebody. He didn't even know, right? They didn't give them the death penalty. That's how civilized they were. Who were these civilized people? Right?
Yeah.
They were the Austro-Hungarian Empire. The Austrians, Hungarians, Czechoslovaks, Romanians, Bulgarians.
Yeah, but what about the American archetype? Time's running out.
Exactly. They didn't all speak the same language. And so that's why I'm saying your caller is exactly right. The idea of this... making an ideal out of nationalism for all the members of one ethnic group is a very distinct idea. It's a very strong idea. The more I think about it, the more I see all the examples falling into place. The ones he mentioned, the Kurds.
Right, yeah, but what about the American archetype? You say that dream...
Okay, America was not formed on that. America is probably the first society in human history that was formed on an ideology. It was not formed on an ethnic preference. People overlook this fact because they keep talking about WASPs.
And what's the ideology?
It's kind of hard to sum it up in one word, but...
The melting pot?
No. The rational a republic.
Yeah.
Based on the rational and cooperative self-interest, right, of people who believed in the rule of man over his own affairs, as opposed to the rule of tyrants, the rule of monarchs, the rule of churches. These were all the specific ideas, and they were indeed linked with Freemasonry at the beginning of America.
Yeah.
They came over here, they didn't want kings. That was one thing, that they were very ready to accept authority, but they wanted a republican authority. They wanted it under God, but based on ideals taken from Greece, ideals taken from the French Revolution, and so on and so forth. But they did not base it on one language, one ethnic group, or anything like that. It just happened to fall out in the English language.
And that ideal is more appropriate to our time?
Well, it's a unique... if you look around, if you stop and think about it, put your brain back to when America started, right?
We've got to go, Dubs. You got to be fast.
There was no other country or place in the world that was floating a prospect or an idea that was even remotely like that.
Okay.
And as your caller says, anti-Americanism has become more popular in America than anywhere else, and he's quite right. And so this obscures this for everybody. We grew up with this over our breakfast cereal, but America is absolutely unique. It's a society which is based on equality and love for all, based on...
Okay, so as we get more imploded into the global theater and the world government, then the American national entity will become the most nostalgically potent
root form of
national identity that we will use as a guide.
The only one could compete with it would be communism.
Okay.
Well, communism didn't work.
So listen, Dublin, this show is basically a ritual, and you always seem to be the last word. So congratulations for providing wonderful last words over
the past...
Listen,
I give another last word. Happy Christmas out there, guys.
Oh, okay.
All right?
Yeah.
And a good new year.
Okay, well, thanks for contributing to our show so much this year, Dublin, and we'll hope to hear from you in January.
Thanks for being here.
Okay.
Thanks.
So, Mike, date on the air?
Oh, sorry. Well, I was saying 5 minutes. We have 5 minutes until 5:02. So
yeah,
we still got like 4 minutes.
Oh, that's good. We gotta stop around too. So we gotta end it off. We got callers?
Yes, there's one call on hold.
Maybe they want to just say Merry Christmas or Happy Nimrod. Check them out.
You want to go to it and see what it's about?
Check with Rob.
He'll
let us go over a bit. I just don't want him to cut off to him like Kent would do.
Okay, we'll have a 3-minute phone call.
Okay.
Hello.
Hi. It's Rob from Not Magazine. Hi.
Oh, yeah, Rob, one of the first propagators for Bob.
Exactly. Well, I thought that no one was going to wish you a Merry Christmas and a Happy New Year, so I thought I'd better be the one to do it. So, I knew I only had about a minute, so I thought I'd get the phone call in there and wish you guys all the best for 91.
Well, Rob, you know, you have so much pink inside you that, and you don't listen enough to know that it's not wise to wish me Merry Christmas or Happy New Year. You know, that's not in my realm of opportunity, psychic preference. But, Rob, you haven't heard any of the shows the past 3 months, have you?
I have not been as dedicated a listener.
Yeah, you're just a hijacker. You featured us in Not Magazine and this magazine, and we appreciate it, but we know you're not a good student, Rob.
Come on.
And so it's the kind of person like you that would wish me and Mike, you know, Happy Nimrod Day. So that's the way it goes. That proves this year has not converted you, and you probably represent millions, so you get the last word. We have to continue another year because we failed miserably, and Rob is the example.
Well, I'm glad I served some purpose tonight.
You do.
Okay.
That's the wonderful thing about media ecology. There's nothing old under the sun.
Okay.
Okay?
All right.
Thanks a lot, Rob. Okay, Mike. Just want to make one point. Why does the Swipto go louder right when you do that? We go from phone to something else, eh? Okay. Anyways, the second message at the beginning of the show was from Guelph, and he was quoting Finnegan's Wake, and he's feeling like he was lost in the bush, and he talked about Lee Conley Fowle, the bird, what man dreams to do in the future, a bird has already done. That is from Finnegan's Wake, page 112, which is 11-2. So there's the 22, ended off the year from Finnegan's Wake with a quote from the 22 element. So thanks to all the sub-Jesus for making this the best church of global theater situation.
Can I squeeze something in 1 minute? I didn't get to my newspaper article.
Let's mention that, yeah.
I've already sort of tucked it away. But
this is a picture of Bob.
This is the Toronto Star, and I never buy the Star.
No.
But there it was. And
What day? Look it up.
It would have been, I think, a week this Thursday.
Okay.
So a week today.
And the headline is How a Quiet Californian Comes or Came to Terrorize the U.S.
Really?
Yeah.
They describe him? Okay, tell us.
It turns out Killer Bob is really Gentle Frank.
Frank Silva.
Frank Silva. You know about Frank Silva.
Not much, no.
Frank Silva was the prop man on Twin Peaks.
Really?
It was his responsibility to stack the donuts on the set of Twin Peaks. And then one day David Lynch said, Bob, or Frank,
yeah,
kneel down by that bed and look angry.
And then
Frank became Bob.
He fit the role.
He fit the role.
So Lynch did not have an idea of what he was doing?
No, Silva has been ordered, with a gag order. He's been told not to speak to the press at all. And prior to the gag order, he spoke to a couple of newspapers, one from a small town in California where he comes from,
yeah,
and the other, a paper somewhere in the South, the Arkansas Gazette. And at the time, he said, well, no, we don't use scripts on Twin Peaks. He said, David will just sort of come over to me and whisper something in my ear and I'll do it.
It's a documentary.
But essentially, he's a props person, Frank Silver.
Well, the key is Frank, said John Wester Harding the key is Frank, said Bob Dylan, and the liner notes to John Wesley Harding, and Frank was a prophet for Bob, so it's key that Frank, no longer a victim of Silva mind control, would emanate the Bob variety, the Bob virus. And that poor guy, he is stigmatized worse than the song Blue Velvet, right? Yeah. I mean, that person can't walk around. I remember someone told me they saw a guy look like him in a cafe on Queen Street and ran out very scared of this person. What a face to have from now on, eh? The Bob face. So I bet you a psychic told him that he would be a national figure. An international figure 6 months ago, he wouldn't have believed it.
Yeah.
Or a year ago. So, Mike, psychism is rearview mirror. We make it up as we go. That's why we resonate with David Lynch. Mike whispers in my ear, I whisper in his, and we get that intimacy which is necessary in the tactile form of radio.
Well, let's take a time now and thank all our listeners and callers who have contributed to this show and have kept the ratings up and have allowed us to stay on the air as long as we have. And it's been a good year.
Yeah, and listen to me on CBC January 1st.
That's right.
On Brave New Waves at night, 11:30. And you'll understand what's going to happen in 1991. It's going to be a fast-moving and shocking year, just like this one. Okay, so
we'll be back in 3 weeks. I'll see everyone in 1 week.
Have okay. Merry holidays, Mike, and enjoy the slack that I've given you. And we'll hear from the profile of the Anglo-American oil companies in the future. All right, so I welcome response, 657-8040.
Praise God.
Carson presents Change of Heart, Friday and Saturday.